Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in French Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Roxanne Penchassi. My guest in this episode is Carolyn Eichner, the author of The Paris Commune, A Brief History, and the book was published by Rutgers University Press in 2022. Welcome, Carolyn.
Thank you, Roxanne.
I think I've said this to you before, Carolyn, that your book has the coolest publication date of any book I can think of because its official publication date was March 18th. Is that right?
Exactly. The beginning of the commune.
How are you doing, Carolyn?
I'm doing well, thank you.
How's the pandemic been for you? Where have you been? I mean, maybe I shouldn't ask you where you've been because I know you're a traveler and that'll take up all of our time. But can you tell us where you're joining us from and how things have been for you the last couple of years?
Well, I'm at home in Milwaukee, and this is where I was for the bulk of the pandemic. And I spent a significant chunk of it writing this book. I had a fellowship, the Institute for Research in the Humanities at University of Wisconsin in Madison. And so I wasn't teaching in 2020 to 2021. I had to be home. And when Kristen Ross asked if I would like to write this book, even though I was finishing another book, I thought, you know, I can't do anything else. So I might as well just take this amazing and fun opportunity. And and I did. And then I worked night and day. I mean, I really worked night
and day. Yeah. I mean, I know we were in touch a little bit while you were working on it, and it just sounded like a really intense process. And I'm going to want to come back to what it was like to be working on the commune. I mean, the writing and all of that, I'm sure, was really challenging. But just to be specifically thinking about the commune and its politics and events and thematics and all of that during this period that we've been living through, I'm real curious to know about what kinds of connections you were making and how you think that might have influenced the way this book turned out, this wonderful book turned out that is so beautiful to look at. I love the cover.
Thank you. It's the flag of the commune. Yeah.
Before I ask you about the book and your experience of the book, I just want to go back. You mentioned that Kristen Ross asked you to participate in the series. So it's a new series, and this is the first book out in
exactly.
The series. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah. And the series is called Reinventions of the Paris Commune. And so, you know, my book is the first, and then Owen Holland's Literature and Revolution, British Responses to the Paris Commune, is the second one. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so the idea is new, interesting, different approaches to the commune. And with A Brief History, she noted that there really hadn't been a brief history written in English in probably about 50 years.
And as someone who teaches the commune regularly, I am so grateful for this book. I taught a course in the spring of 2021 on the commune, and the book, you were writing it at the time. But next time I teach that class, I'm definitely going to be assigning this one. And I think a lot of people who are listening will be interested in that as well, because it's so accessible, it's brief, and it's so recent, right, compared to some of the things that are available for all of us who read about and think about and teach the commune. I always ask people, Carolyn, like, why France? So do you want to tell us that story of how you became you're lots of things, but in that mix is a French historian. So
sure. Yes. I had a slightly circuitous path. My undergraduate degree is in finance, which
what?
I neither liked nor was good at. But yeah, yeah, exactly. I thought I had to do something practical. I was an undergrad for 6 years, kind of roaming through majors and always taking a lot of history and English classes. But it just did not occur to me that that could be, you know, some sort of career. So I got a degree in finance, and I worked in marketing for about a year, and I was profoundly miserable. So my mother asked me what I would do in a perfect world, and I said study history. And I didn't really know what that meant, and honestly, neither did my parents, who were incredibly supportive. And so I went back to Northern Illinois University, which is where I had gotten my undergraduate degree, and took graduate classes as a student at large. And I was already a feminist. My mother was a sort of Betty Friedan era feminist, and raised us with that. And so I was interested in women, and I was interested in leftist politics and radicalism. And so I had three classes, one on Marx, taught by Margaret George, and one on modern Europe, taught by Harvey Smith, and one on absolutism in France, taught by Bill Bike. And I had had no connection to France before this, but I just was kind of swept up in France's radical tradition. And then when I encountered the commune, I just thought, I'm like, wait a minute, were there women in this? And it was really, and then I thought, well, I think I can do this history thing. And I applied for to be in the MA program there. And they said I needed to pick a country. And I knew no French. And they said that there was a translation course being offered in the summer. And if I took that, it would fulfill the requirement. And so I called on the telephone, and there was one space left in it. And so I'm a French historian.
That's awesome.
And I'm very, very happy about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and so are we all. That's a great story. And I mean, you mentioned that somewhere along the line, you had that question about whether or not there were women involved in the commune. And if we know that that is absolutely the case, it's partly thanks to you.
Thank you.
Including that 2004 book, Surmounting the Barricades, published with Indiana University Press.
Yes.
And you've got another book that I could ask you about later, but I'll just mention it now, Feminism's Empire, that has at least one commune art in there, right?
It has two. It has Louise Michel and Paul Menck.
That's right. And that one's coming out in June, well, next month.
Exactly.
Is that right? And a shout out to Mike Van, my colleague, who is also a colleague on the NBN, who will be interviewing you for New Books in History for that one, because I can't take up all of the Carolyn Eichner time on the network. We're going to share you. Okay, so this book, Kristen Ross invited you. You've written about the commune before. You had nothing else pressing going on during the pandemic. Writing a brief history, I guess I want to ask you first and foremost, like as someone who's worked on the commune for years and comes back to it in various ways, like how challenging it was to get this, to get it down to, I don't know, this very manageable, but probably not from your perspective writing it, just over 100 pages. Like, what's it like to write a brief history?
Challenging.
Yeah.
It was possible because I've been thinking about the commune for so long. It's something that, you know, I mean, and talking about it and teaching it. And then I just really, to distill it down, I mean, it's difficult because I love details, and I have to refrain from, you know, kind of getting lost in details. And so, you know, my partner is incredibly helpful, Kenan Ferguson, political theorist, I'll shout out there. And so together we worked on, because he has, you know, lived with a commune for a couple of decades now. And so, I used him as a real sounding board and you know, made it an outline and just kept kind of tightening it, and then thought about it kind of telling a, a story in a way, but with obviously a narrative, you know, with analysis and interpretation and you know, all of that good scholarly stuff. And so it was actually it was fun. The writing was fun some days, other days less so.
Sure.
But just really, you know, just kind of trying to follow a thread. I decided to, you know, pick certain figures the way I thought about writing it and the narrative, and to make it, you know, more accessible, and to make people be able to connect with the different actors in the commune. I you know, just thought about, okay, I'll think, you know, focus on these three women and three men, and kind of weave them in and out. And it's not like I just focus on these six people, but it was a way of kind of focusing the narrative.
Okay, before we go any further, I mean, as you know, Carolyn, I'm no scholar of the commune per se, but I'm a huge fan of that history. I like to teach classes on it. I like to talk about it, read about it all the time. People think I work on the Paris Commune sometimes. I'm like, no, mm-hmm. I work on the post-1945 period. So you and I talking, we can probably fall into the trap of taking stuff for granted. So let's, before we go any further, just give people who might not be as familiar with this history the brief version of the brief history of the commune.
Right.
What was the Paris Commune? Go.
Yeah, it's like the elevator pitch, right? All right, the Paris Commune was a 72-day-long revolutionary civil war, right, immediately following the Franco-Prussian War in 1871. The Franco-Prussian War, which was not going well for France anyway, and France surrendered to Prussia, partially because it was more concerned about the activist working-class population in Paris than it was about the Prussians. Mm. And then immediately, the new government immediately took a number of measures that, let's say, undermined the life and well-being of the working classes, and, you know, financial measures that were repressive, and that led to increased unrest in Paris, mm-hmm. and ultimately to March 18th, mm-hmm. when there were cannons left in Montmartre after the Franco-Prussian War, and sitting up on the butte overlooking the city, and the French powers that be were very uncomfortable with this, since Montmartre was a completely working class area, and they sent mm-hmm. troops up there in the pre-dawn hours. The horses were delayed, and the troops stood there and waited, and then as the sun rose, women came out of their houses to get bread and milk for their families, and saw the soldiers and said, "What are you doing?" And stepped between them and the cannons, and the soldiers turned around and arrested their leaders, and thus began this revolutionary civil war, mm-hmm. which is often termed the first, I call it a sort of socialistic revolution. It's not quite socialist, mm-hmm. I don't think. But it was a 72-day experiment in radical democracy while under siege by the French National Army, and the project of social and political and economic transformation was going on at the same time as defending the city in a civil war. Mm-hmm. How's that?
That's great. Because it's a hard thing to, you know, I mean, I remember what somebody who wasn't as familiar with the commune's history, when I decided I wanted to teach a class on it, you know, I was like, I'm going to teach a class on this 72-day episode. And it was such a fun challenge to do that and to have that kind of time. But it's still like there's so many things that I ended up having to leave out. So,
right.
Yeah. So it's just a fascinating history. And this book comes at it and presents it to, well, a real wide range in terms of a potential audience. So I guess that's another question I wanted to ask you, Carolyn. Like, when you were writing this book and thinking about who it was for, who were your imagined readers?
Students, an interested and engaged general population of, you know, activists or people who are interested in France, people who are interested in revolutions, you know, people who are interested in civil war, people who are interested in radical social change, and also fellow scholars and historians of France and the Paris Commune, because it's a brief history, but it's also my scholarly intervention, more recent scholarly intervention in the historiography of the commune.
Yeah, and I think what you've produced, I mean, the book is so readable that I can completely imagine all of those different potential readers getting so much out of it.
Thank you.
Was that part of the fun of writing it, that you got to, did you feel like you were writing in a different register than you? I mean, I've read your other work. It's all, you know, compelling to read, but did you feel like a different type of writer putting this book together?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And it's something that I've done a couple of times before, and I really enjoy it. I have a piece on Louise Michel and the Kanak in New Caledonia in the British political literary journal Salvage. It's China Mayville's. And then I've done a couple of other things for different, you know, kind of sites that were more intended for a general audience. And I enjoy this kind of writing. And so it was fun. It's, you know, more, you know, a little more, I get to try to bring the excitement more to the forefront. And with a topic like the commune, it's, there's a lot of excitement. And so I've tried really hard to make it something that people could feel and visualize when they were reading it.
Yeah. I mean, that visuality, I guess, is really there throughout. And there's so many questions I have about how you put the book together and the kinds of decisions, some of them really hard, I imagine, that you had to make. But the first one, I guess, I want to ask has to do with the parts of the book, you know, these three mm-hmm. chapters, these really provocative, kind of beautiful titles for these mm-hmm. three parts, Illumination, Fluorescence, and Explosion. Can you say a little bit about how you came to those three and how they kind of structure the book?
Sure. It's basically before, during, and then the, like, end and into mm-hmm. after. But I thought about it as, you know, something that lit up and burned brightly and beautifully and then exploded and went out but didn't really go out. So that was it. And I, you know, was trying to think about a way. I mean, once I settled on this kind of idea of fire and burning, I thought that made sense because of the fires, but also because of the passion connected to it and the mm-hmm. kind of passion that was expressed by the communards and the kind of passion that so many people have about the commune in, you know, the ensuing 150 years. And so I thought the illumination is, you know, here we're going to, there's the light that's beginning to burn as we move towards this event, and then the fluorescence of the event itself, and then the explosion and its aftermath.
Yeah. No, I especially love the way that, I mean, it carried me through the whole book, but, you know, when I was beginning the book, that each subsection of that first part, Illumination, has sparks in front of it. Like it's, I mean, it's not just cute, right? It's sort of exciting to read it and you kind of get the sense of a building. And then, yeah, I do associate fire for obvious reasons with the commune, but then all of those other types of resonances of light and burning and the explosive quality. Like it's just interesting too, because surveys of the commune, you know, they tend to follow, like this is following it chronologically, but they tend to follow a pattern in their tables of contents in their organization that you're tracking here, like those events in the order that they happened in. I'm thinking of those tables of contents that are like the siege, then, you know, March 18th, then, you know, the early days or whatever, like women, and then, you know, the bloody week at the end. And it sort of has this, and maybe legacies if we're lucky. So I just was curious to ask you about how the way you set that up maybe mm-hmm. is in response, or like what impact you think it has on that arc of the story that we tell.
Well, thank you for that. Thinking about in the first chapter using sparks, I mean, I literally was thinking about like what were the different, you know, elements that mm-hmm. that went into it. And so each is a spark, right? So it's the city, you know, politics, the public meetings at the end of the empire, you know, the international, and then, you know, the empire extinguished, right? So mm-hmm. you've got these sparks, and then you have the sort of counter thing extinguished. And so I thought that, you know, this would, I hoped at least that this would present each piece fitting into, you know, the puzzle, if you will, of what created and led to the commune, but, you know, while keeping this theme of, you know, of fire and kind of glowing and illumination. And, you know, instead of saying just, you know, contributing factors, right? It was just, it seemed like a more interesting way of setting it up.
You mentioned, Carolyn, that the book is kind of anchored and returns again and again to these central figures of the commune, and that you chose to divide that evenly between women and men who were involved. And yeah, I guess I just want to ask you about that choice that, knowing you, seems like, of course, Carolyn did that. But yeah, just what it means for you to write a history, even in a brief history, that is not, that is meant to cover the commune, what it means to you to like how gender figures in this book, given that feminism and the role of women and gender is such a central part of the other work that you do, like how you kind of work that out.
Well, thanks for that question. Yeah, I think for me, one of the really important things was to fundamentally integrate women and gender into the history of the commune. And so to not have a, you know, the Paris Commune, a brief history that includes women and gender, you know, but like it's not part of the title, right? It's just part of the history because it's part of the history, you know, it's right. not, it's, and so, and so, you know, in writing it, I wanted to include in the narrative, the characters, you know, the actors, because it's, when readers and students really like it, but readers like that to be able to, you know, get a sense of who these people were, who were involved, and to get, to have them, you know, represent different strands of feminism or different strands of socialism, or both, but to really, really, it's just gender, women are completely integrated into the book because they were completely integrated into the event, well, as mm-hmm. they're completely integrated into history. Huh. Mm-hmm. So, or should be. It was a very central thing for me.
Well, and it's really there as a reader, you know, it's not, you know, as I said before, it's like, it's not like the women and gender chapter or whatever. It's just
right
kind of there all the way through. And of course, the roles that women and men played in the commune were different in some ways, and there were constraints and like all of these things and exclusions that persisted throughout the commune, and there are critiques to be made, but they're integrated into that history in this way. So that's kind of me connecting this brief history to both of the other books, one which is almost out. But the other question I had for you has to do with how this brief history of the Paris Commune situates the commune in relationship to empire, which I know plays a real central role in the book that's about to come out. So yeah, I'm kind of mm-hmm. curious about how writing this book after finishing the other one or before, how you've been writing two books at the same time. I can't keep up. What's going on?
Yeah. I've actually been writing three books at the same time.
Oh, good Lord. Okay.
which I don't advise that approach. You know, because of the, you know, so the brevity of this book, there is it's really, you know, the end that engages questions of empire and, you know, briefly, the brevity of the book. But it does, you know, primarily because of the 4,500 communards that were exiled to the prison colony in New Caledonia mm-hmm. in the South Pacific. And that actually segues into the Feminism's Empire book, which while focusing one of the five feminists in that book is Louise Michel, because I look at the first five feminists of the latter half of the 19th century to engage with empire. And it's Louise Michel, and she's sent to New Caledonia, and it changes her politics and her understanding of oppression and equity, and she becomes anti-imperialist. And then, so I talk a bit about, you know, that and the other communards sent to New Caledonia. And then also the fact that, at the same time as the commune is happening, that there's a anti-imperial uprising in Algeria. And once that's crushed, then the Kabyle leaders of that are sent to New Caledonia. But also at the same time as that, there is a commune formed in Algeria, in Algiers. And those, they're mostly veterans of 1848 who'd been exiled there. And they have no interest in anti-imperialism or imperialism, but there were quite a number of communes that rose up around, mostly around France. And at the beginning of the commune, the one in Marseille lasted 10 days. And I think that was the longest one. Mm-hmm. But this one in Algiers was just very, very brief. So there's that kind of connection, mm-hmm. but that's really, you know, about it because of, again, the parameters of the book.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, and I think, you know, it's one of those things where reading the book, knowing your other work, and like I could just sort of tell that there was a sensitivity to those questions and concerns, and I knew it was coming. And so I guess another question I have has to do with, you know, you mentioned a couple of times how you wanted to make a particular kind of intervention. And I know just from speaking with Emile Chabal and some other historians who've written some of these briefer histories, that it's a real challenge to, you know, do the coverage of like the content events to provide that overview for people, but then to also figure out a way to make the book your own in terms of an intervention historically, historiographically, in terms of analysis, you know, your political take, whatever it is that you want to get in there. And so I wonder, you could tell us a little bit about how you balanced that, how you worked on that part of the project. And then, yeah, what you hope that people will take away from this brief history as, you know, some of those interventions that you've wanted to make with this book.
Because the commune is still such a hotly contested event, and the historiography is still so contentious in many ways, I this was what I was, you know, hoping to do, to you know, intervene and present my perspective and my scholarly perspective, and to, you know, talk about the commune as looking both backwards and forward, as being influenced by the French Revolution, but also being an experiment in radical democracy. And this is why I talk about the central chapter, I talk about the politics, the socioeconomic, economics and social cultural, the aspects of the commune, and the kind of originality that was going on, the kind of experimentation in politics and culture and economics. There are some scholars who term the commune a failure, and I vociferously argue against this. I mean, the commune was crushed, but I see it as this model for quite a broad range and type and number of progressive movements in the next 151 years so far. And that it really kind of opened up a lot of routes to progressive and or radical change. And so I think that because I had been reading a number of things that were terming the commune a failure, I was wanted to make clear that I argued against that and show that with the scholarship, you know, within the limits of the pages that I could, but also show the connections to the French Revolution, the consciousness of the revolutionary past, and the consciousness of looking to the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is as good a time as any to come back to that question I had earlier about, like, writing this book when you were writing it, you know, I mean, it's got lots of parts, this question of mine, because it's like writing this book when you were writing it and thinking about it around the 150th anniversary, which is its own thing. But then to have that, and again, I keep coming back to this class I taught in the spring of 2021, to have that happening, that kind of commemorative moment where just there was, I don't know, it was super exciting last year, right? Like it always is when people revisit and come back to things. But last year, there's just this explosion of stuff, you know, meetings, conversations, publications, happenings. I mean, all within the constraints of the pandemic, but things happening on Zoom or whatever, like all the stuff. And then also the world like was also, I mean, it's in the world, but like the rest of the world was also happening. And so I don't know if there's an easy way for you to tell us about that, but like, what was that like?
Well, I had been looking forward to this anniversary, the 150th mm-hmm. anniversary, and had hoped to spend a fair amount of time in Paris or in France for speaking at conferences and just being there. And so that obviously didn't happen during the, mm-hmm. the time. But there were many, you know, Zoom talks and conferences and things that I participated in, which was great. And in some ways, you know, probably then were seen by more people and more people were able to participate mm. than, you know, would have otherwise. But so first of all, there was this sort of, you know, kind of frustration and sense of loss just on my part. And then obviously on the part of anyone else experiencing this, which is, you know, so many people, the way that this couldn't be commemorated in the way that many people had hoped. And then there's, you know, there's the pandemic and there's Black Lives Matter and there's, you know, all mm-hmm. of this stuff going on. And I just, in a way, immersing myself in writing about this. And as I said, you know, I really see the commune as this kind of, you know, roadmap to, you know, many future ends. And I felt like, well, this was, it's almost in a way an extra level of inspiration as in trying to create this accessible, readable, digestible version of the commune that would then, you know, be out there in the world. I mean, I had, you know, hoped that it would come out during 2021. That was the original intent, and Rutgers thought it could, but, you know, it just couldn't. It feels like a sort of activism in bringing this history and its many aftermaths to a wider audience and to those who already know it in a slightly different way. And mm-hmm. You know, honestly, it was like immersing myself in this was a way of really feeling more engaged. You know, it was like I just dove in, and then, you know, there wasn't necessarily all of the news of the, you know, dying people and people, you know, rejecting vaccinations and masks and all mm-hmm. this. I could just kind of turn that off and, you know, for many hours a day and write this. And it was very helpful for me to have this project. I mean, I had the Feminism's Empire and, you know, but this
other book that you're writing. Yeah.
Right. And then there's a third one. But it really was, you know, having the fellowship, not teaching, you know, just being in my house, just and having the resources to do this too, because, you know, there was a pandemic. I couldn't go to the library, but the amazing, wonderful interlibrary loan people at my university. And then the fact that so much has been digitized, obviously when I wrote Surmounting the Barricades, nothing was digitized. And then I also have extensive files of photocopies from when I did my dissertation research and when I was writing Surmounting the Barricades. It was like all of these factors came. I think if any one of these factors wasn't there, I couldn't have done it during the pandemic,
right.
But it gave it an extra level of kind of meaning and urgency.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I'm sure it did. And I guess, I mean, with specificity when it comes to 2021, but I'm going to ask you kind of an absurd question, Carolyn, which I ask myself too, especially because I, you know, I'm a C2021 person. Like, what is it about the commune that, you know, pulls me back all the time? Why do I love it so much? Or why do I love thinking about it so much? Like, what is it? Because, you know, I mean, the people I meet and have exchanges with about the commune, yeah, there's French historians. There's people who are interested in the 19th century in other countries, you know, who are interested perhaps in what people had to say about the commune in, you know, the United States or other parts of the world, connections people make to the context where I live in Canada. Like, there's that. There's literature people, you know, but then there's the whole world of universe of various people on the left and what the commune means to them, and lots of different like groups of people. And it's just like got this, it just comes back again and again. And there's a this mythology around it, this short-lived period. What do you think, like if you ever think about this, I mean, maybe it just kind of comes naturally to you to be into it. But when you observe that, the ways that people, not just academics, you know, artists, writers of other kinds, musicians, political activists, like the way that they come back to the commune and on the scale that they do and with the intensity, like, what do you think it is about it that motivates people and inspires them so much?
I think it's the optimism, despite the brutal ending, the fact that it's almost like what you're describing feeds on itself and replicates itself, right? And people see this, I did a Zoom discussion with a really good old friend of mine. It was sponsored by the American Friends Service Committee, her name's Mary Zirkle, and she's worked for them for a long time. And we did a Zoom discussion of this book, you know, for a broader audience, mostly activists. And afterwards, when we were talking, she said, and we've been friends since college. And she said, you know, honestly, before I read this book, I couldn't quite understand how you could stay focused on something for so long, what it was that would keep you so engaged with this. And then she said, and then she, after the reading the book and then our conversation, she's like, now I completely get it. And I think it's that, you know, this, you know, what I was saying before about it kind of creating this, you know, roadmap to so many places, and that it engages the imaginations and the intellect and the hope of people, you know, as you said, is the artists, you know, musicians, theater, there's so, you know, so many kinds of events that went on last year, you know, virtually, but that I'm going back to Brecht writing about the commune. And I think that on the other, the flip side of that is that this is why there is still such anti-commune fervor amongst the French sort of center and right too, because it's threatening in the same reason that Thiers and the French army were hell-bent on crushing the commune, not just, you know, putting it down, but on this brutal like decimation of the participants and of the event itself, to make an example, to say this can never happen again, because the eyes of the world were on them, capitalist elite eyes of the world were on them, and it was, the ball was in the French National Army's court to make sure that people understood that if they tried this again, there would be a brutal and bloody end. But that the fact that that did not extinguish the hope and optimism and examples that it created and obviously still creates, it makes it, you know, just it continues to be this, like, you know, beacon of potential And it depends on which side you're standing on, whether that's a wonderful potential or a horrible and terrifying potential. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, inversions of class and gender, you know.
Just to kind of go swing in maybe not the opposite direction, but a different direction. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it sort of makes me think, like, I've had a lot more conversations about the commune with non-French historians than I have with French historians when I really think about it. I mean, there's you. Like, and there's other people, you know, who work on the commune. But, and I certainly had more conversations with French historians about the commune last year around the 150th anniversary. But, like, that's the other thing about it. It's like, I'm a French historian, so it seems to make sense that mm-hmm. I'd be interested in this history. But it's not really what... It's not really what brought me to it, what sticks me, like keeps me coming back to it. It's not so much the fact that, I mean, of course that's part of it, but, and so I'm kind of curious about that too. Like, as someone who's been working on this for a while, whether you've noticed a shift or whether you have observations about like the place the commune has in our field.
Well, the main thing is that it's just, you know, the interest really, you know, took off around the anniversary, which, you know, which makes sense. And there was a bit of a rise and, you know, more of a little more than a blip, you know, for the 140th anniversary. I participated in a conference in Narbonne that generated a pretty wonderful collection edited by Laure Goudineau mm-hmm. and Marc César. And so there was, you know, the sort of the anniversary effect, basically. And, you know, I think that, and I think it's sort of reflected in the fact that there really haven't been, there hasn't been a brief history written in so long since, you know, right around the time of the 100th anniversary. And I mean, there certainly has been a you know, mm-hmm. scholarship since then, but, this anniversary really, I think, the number itself, 150, and then just the state of the world and all of these goings on, I think drew more and more attention to it.
No, I think that's right. I know that the first that surmounting the barricades has been recently. What is time? I mean, maybe it was 2 years ago already.
Yeah.
Translated into French. When did the French translate?
Yes. Yeah. It was 2020. It was just in time for the pandemic.
Okay, and I'm like, just last week.
Yeah, no, just in time for it to be literally stuck in the warehouse for months at Edition de la Sorbonne.
No.
Yeah, oh yeah, it was, people couldn't get it, and it was, yeah, the timing was terrible.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry about that, but
thanks.
I'm glad that it's
me
out.
Too.
And I guess I wonder, like, with that book, this book, we won't talk about the other ones yet, but... you know, this idea of like, well, especially Anglo audience, but a more kind of outside of France audience versus a French audience, like with that other book and with Surmounting the Barricades and with this one, like, I guess I wonder what you think about your audience in terms of non-French types, French types, like, yeah, do you have different things to say, or do you think the reception of something like this would be different in the French context? Like, I don't know if there's a plan for this one to come out in French, but I just wonder about that because I do also, and this is all anecdotal, like have different kinds of conversations sometimes with people who are working in a like a North American or Anglophone context on the commune or thinking about it. And, you know, the status that it has, the place that it has, and the different kinds of silences about it in the French context. So I just wonder how you think that.
Yeah, I mean, it, as of now, at least there are no, you know, plans for this to be translated. I would absolutely love for it to be translated. But there was, in the last year or so, there was quite the outpouring of publications
I'm sure,
in France. Yeah. So I don't know what that says about the audience waiting for another brief history, especially one by an American. I don't know, but I mean I would love to have this come out. But having Surmounting the Barricades come out in French, and I want to shout out to my wonderful translator Bastien Crépin. Mm-hmm. You know, having that come out in France was extremely important to me to have because of the, you know, centrality of women and issues of gender in the commune, and the fact that that had been, you know, not exactly a central factor in much of the French language historiography before that. So that was very exciting for me to have that come out in French. And I think I would love to have this come out in French and to then see what kind of response it would have.
Just, I wonder sometimes, you know, that we, and it's not even like we all agree or do things the same way, but that there's a different approach to certain, especially contentious political and historical issues in France, that people writing from the outside are able to, or might emphasize, or might explore, poke at things that might be more sensitive in a French context, or there might be a bit more resistance to, or less,
yes,
yeah, more silence about. And so I just wondered about that, because as you say, there was so much activity. I mean, I was just following like online in France around this anniversary last year. And I don't know, I haven't tracked all the anniversaries, but I mean, there have always been dedicated groups of people who, you know, are interested in having people understand and know about the commune's history, but it just felt like a much more generalized kind of commemoration or broader commemoration.
Yeah, yeah. And the what you said about the, you know, particular sensitivities, I was at I presented at a conference in Lausanne in Switzerland in the fall, and part of what I was talking about is Louise Michel in New Caledonia and the way in which she was the only communard to consistently support the Kanak and their uprising against the French in their in 1878, you know, including that the sort of the fact that quite a number of communards actually fought on the side of the French against the Kanaks, someone choosing, you know, whiteness and civilization over some kind of solidarity. There was a bit of tension about this, me criticizing the communards, and it was very clear that this was, you know, kind of there was a bit of tension about that. But I think, you know, there's a lot of attachment to the commune, as there is, you know, and it's a similar thing in my book Feminism's Empire. I talk about the feminist use of the figure of the Jew in 19th century France and the empire for all sorts of things, to advance political positions, and you know, this figure of the Jew as something that was kind of easily accessible and a clear point of reference, and the way that, for example, Olympe d'Huart, the monarchist feminist with Republican sympathies, who was a raging anti-Semite, and Hubertine Auclair, who used anti-Semitism in instrumentalized ways to try to advance the cause of women's suffrage. And I have had a fair amount of resistance to that because of the criticizing of these feminists, whereas I'm not actually criticizing them. I'm talking about what they said and what they did, in the same way that with the communards, I'm talking about what they said and what they did. And, you know, I mean, it's not a secret that I'm super sympathetic to the commune and or to feminists. I mean, here's the reveal.
What?
I know, exactly.
In a surprise move.
I know. Oh my goodness. But you know, if you're doing the work and you're trying to talk about what happened and why, you have to talk about the unpleasant and nasty parts. But it depends. Yeah. There are, you know, communities of interest who feel more protective of these, you know, historical actors. And I mean, honestly, when I was doing the work on the, you know, Feminism's Empire, and when I didn't plan on looking at the way that they talked about Jews or looked at Jews at all. And I just kept coming across it. And, you know, quite honestly, it was disturbing and disappointing, but it didn't mean, you know, that I had to write about it. It really connects with empire.
Maybe it's an academic thing. Like, I can be a fan and a critic at the same time. I have no problem with that. I just roll them together, you know, like, well, you do X well. I would have liked to hear more about or less about why. You know, Carolyn, just coming back to this thing about, you know, the mythology and various people's, including my own, obsessions with the commune. Like, what do you think about? Well, I think it was Kristen Ross who said, you know, at the beginning of Communal Luxury, like somewhere, that, you know, it's not about lessons. Like, it's not about history mm-hmm. giving us lessons. It's about history offering us like a, what did she say, archive toolbox. Like, there's stuff there that we can go look at and we can think about our current moment in relationship to those questions that are raised, to that politics, all those kinds of things. And I guess, yeah, I asked you about writing this while all this stuff was going down. But what do you think about the commune? Like, how do you make sense of that, its relevance in the contemporary moment? I mean, especially as somebody who has this real close relationship with so many of these figures and what they wrote and what they said and what they did. I mean, I think I know a little bit about these people, but it's nothing compared to your connection to them. So yeah, I just wonder how much the politics of this moment, the words and ideas and acts of these people who you've written about over, you know, your career, really, how much you see them as a repository for contemporary politics or issues around inequality and social justice and some of those kinds of things. Like, how you, is the commune always just like, are you, you know, when you pick up the paper or whatever, however one absorbs the news these days, is it just like, is the commune like the ding, ding, ding going off all the time where the commune's always popping into your head? What's it like to be Carolyn Eichner in the contemporary moment absorbing the news?
That's fabulous. Happily, no, the commune isn't completely present all the time. That would be scary. Yeah, right. Exactly. Or anyone else. My sister. Oh my god. I detest violence. I see the violent outcome is just a horror. Mm-hmm. And I know that often, you know, violence is unavoidable, but I find it, you know, abhorrent and terrifying. But I see so much of what went on in the commune, and this I really try to talk about, you know, in the book. I talk mm-hmm. this idea of this experiment in radical democracy, you know, this idea that a worker should be able to work all day long and then come home and write a book. So not just read a book, but write a book. So the idea of, you know, egalitarian education and opportunity, control over one's conditions of work and being mm-hmm. able to make a living wage and, you know, these kind of things that the commune tried to do, conceptualizing, the state as something that is directly responsive to the population and has responsibility to the population. These kind of ideas that I see as, you know, this kind of, you know, as you said, this kind of toolbox, or, you know, use this idea of this roadmap. And it's really funny because when I think of the roadmap, I picture kind of a central point within all these roads going off, and then it just kind of fades away because the roads could go anywhere. And this mm-hmm. is kind of my that's funny. I don't know if I've exactly articulated it like that before, but that's how I think about it when I talk about this roadmap with so many potential and so much potential. Thanks. And, you know, it's like, I mean, you see things like, you know, in Occupy Oakland, some young woman was interviewed and asked her name. She said it was Louise Michelle. And, and there was the rescue ship in the Mediterranean rescuing refugees paid for by Banksy. And it's named Louise Michelle. And that Louise Michelle might be a whole other conversation, but that's also something I tried to do I don't directly say this, but I really hope no one ever calls her the Red Virgin again.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
This idea of, I mean, she is often, you know, thought of and remembered as a kind of a caricature, and this idea of this, you know, woman who's married to the revolution as opposed to this, it's super creepy. And it also is just, it erases, I mean, when I wrote Surmounting the Barricades, I very specifically did not write about Louise Michelle, because when I was writing my dissertation, actually, anytime I said anything about women in the Paris Commune, people, whoever, you know, I was speaking with said, Louise Michel? Like, no.
Right.
I mean, it was as though she was the only woman. It was, you know, and so, I mean, she's, you know, in Surmounting the Barricades a little bit, but just a little. So there is some irony that then she is quite, you know, central to feminism's empire, but she is because she was a linguist, a novelist, an anthropologist, a theorist, a poet, an orator. She was extraordinary, and so much of what she accomplished and what she did has been kind of erased or marginalized in this kind of, you know, and some of this, a lot of this comes from the way that the Communist Party in the 20th century really, you know, kind of took her, appropriated her and had her as this image of revolutionary sacrifice and suffering. And yeah, she sacrificed and she suffered, but she did an awful lot more than that. And so that's all. And that's it. That's really more, I mean, she's very much in the brief history, but she's...
Yeah, she's a central figure, and she, you know, people, I'm just thinking of my students right now, like, they're, you know, she's an incredibly charismatic and compelling figure on paper. Like, she, I mean, it's kind of amazing. Yes. I mean, in the images also, but it's like, you know, especially as somebody who teaches the 20th and 21st centuries, like, it's amazing to me to watch how interested my students get in this figure that they don't have, like, a historical film to I mean, I don't watch that film, frankly, but yeah. Why isn't that happening? That should be part
Excellent
of this 150th
question.
Wave. That would be great. I'd worry about it. We'll have to get back together if there is, you know, if there is a film, we could just spend an hour talking about that. Carolyn, it's been so hard to focus on this book because I sort of think of you as this, like, you're a repository of the Commune. And so, and that there are these connections between at least these three publications, but I'm super grateful for all those three projects and the, you know, including the one that's coming out. But you said there's another book?
Yeah, there's another book.
What's next?
It's on personal names. And I actually started it. Yeah. 20 years ago in an NEH summer seminar at Stanford with Marilyn Boxer and Karen Offen on motherhood in the nation state, where, and it came out of the Commune research because Paula Mank, one of the central communards in Surmounting the Barricades, she had a child that she named Lucifer Blanqui. And there, Napoleon had mandated that all French children be named after Catholic saints or heroes from antiquity, and so Lucifer Blanqui, and then another child, Spartacus Revolution.
That's an intense name.
Yeah. Yes, and then she wrote about it, and yeah, and so I just became super interested in this idea of what does it mean to put your politics on a child, an infant, and wrote a paper on it, and then kind of kept coming back to it. And in 2014, I have an article in Signs. Not science, Signs.
Right.
Sometimes when I say that, people say science? No. Signs on the feminist opposition to the patronym in 19th century France. So it's basically the names, you know, project, and that's what I'm going to be working on my sabbatical in the fall. And I've been working on it on and off for, as I said, a long time. But it's about the state's interest in monitoring and controlling names and individuals and groups' interests in having control over their names and, you know, maintaining ethnic or religious traditions and you know, and what that means, where the points of kind of contention. So it's the patronym.
And is that a transnational project, Carolyn, or is it
centered in France.
Yeah.
It's centered in France and its empire, but it is going to have a transnational comparative elements, talking about the revolutionary names during the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution, and because I've been working on this for so long, people send me things about names, and also because everyone has a name and some interest in names, people tell me about that. Yeah, it's really something. It's really it has a particular, you know, resonance, and so I have quite a bit of material, and you know, I mean, it's the part I was most recently working on is that, you know, Napoleon mandated that Jews take permanent first and last names at the beginning of the century. And then with the emancipation of the enslaved people in the Caribbean in 1848, they were given names, often offensive names, last names for which they had no choice. And then at the end of the 19th century, Algerian Muslims were mandated to take, you know, permanent first and last names. And many of the names that they were given were offensive and insulting. And what this sort of means, what it means about assimilation and marking, and the rules differed based on the group. So that's the sort of piece I've been finishing up.
Wow. So, Carolyn, I am so grateful for this book. I'm really looking forward to teaching it and to talking to other people about it, and to hearing more from you about, you know, the kind of history that it has out in the world in various venues, academic and non. I'm really looking forward to Feminism's Empire, and this names project sounds amazing. So I just want to thank you for all that you have done and do, Carolyn, and for talking with me about the Paris Commune, A Brief History.
Thank you, Roxanne. This has been just so interesting and enjoyable for me. Your questions are fabulous. You really just bring up such fascinating things, and it's so, they're so thoughtful and well-informed, and I have thoroughly enjoyed this, and I appreciate it.